to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm great.
Happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Bruce Willis is back in VOD form. That's right, the New York Times has discovered this crazy new trend, big-name actors trading in on their legend for straight-to-VOD and DVD productions. The Bruce Willis Journey from In-Demand to On-Demand is the name of the essay, and it includes fascinating nuggets like, quote, "What struck me most is how much they, that is the movies, rely on gunplay," end quote. And, quote, "The idea of masculinity in these movies, the idea of masculinity these movies project is troubling," end quote. An action star in action movies with guns and men that act manly. It's really quite unfathomable. Joking aside, there is something interesting here about the ways in which distribution and audience tastes are evolving alongside one another. Bruce Willis isn't the first star to trade in on his name to make cheapo action movies. Think Charles Bronson's Cannon days or Jean-Claude Van Damme basically making anything after 1998 or so. Other artists, such as Mel Gibson, have taken a similar tack in recent years, but I would argue with better results, movies like Fat Man or Dragged Across Concrete. That said, there is something interesting about the intensity with which Bruce Willis in particular has done this, and the exploding means of distribution just in general. Today, news broke that Run, Hide, Fight, the movie that was produced by the company on which this podcast originated, is coming to the Daily Wire of all places. Very weird, very unusual, but it's content, right? It's all content. Between Redbox and Video On Demand and the Daily Wire now, there's a whole world of people out there looking for something new who care about nothing more than a face on a box or a good pitch tagline. Alyssa, what is your favorite terrible Bruce Willis movie before we get started on everything else?
So I think one of the reasons that people have this weird reaction to people, to Bruce Willis showing up in these kinds of movies, is that it's possible to think of him primarily as an action star. It's also possible to think of him as sort of a quirky indie actor. And so, you know, my favorite Bruce Willis movies are like Moonrise Kingdom and The Fifth Element. I like Die Hard a lot. My husband should probably not hear me shading Die Hard on this podcast. It's entirely possible to look at Bruce Willis's latest work and be like, beyond the question of making an enormous amount of money for showing up for not very much work, like, what is he doing? Isn't he this interesting, arty actor who's in things like Motherless Brooklyn? And so I think people tend to find, you know, Willis, for all that he is incredibly famous for playing John McClane for other action roles, has this other streak to his career that I think makes this seem particularly discordant to some people.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, Bruce Willis has always kind of struck me as a working actor, like an actor's actor, like in almost in the British mode, yeah. Where you would have, these great British actors like, Sir Alec Guinness or whoever, right? Famously treated Star Wars as like just another silly day of work, right? And you have these guys kind of pop up in movie after movie after movie. And Bruce Willis has always kind of felt that way. Yes, he does some interesting stuff, but also he does, you know, a lot of paycheck work. He's got mouths to feed. He's got kids to raise. He's got mansions.
He famously,
Beverly Hills mansions to pay for.
Hates spending time in the makeup chair. Like, just won't do prep that way, right? Like, won't do anything where he's blue or has to wear a prosthetic or whatever.
Yeah.
And, like, bitches about having to work out, which he has to do. Like, he talks about, he's like, I read the script, and then I read the shooting schedule, and there's, like, 3 days when I got to take my shirt off. And I'm like, well, I guess I got to work out that week.
Yeah.
Right? He just treats it like, well, all right, I guess that week I'm going to have abs.
Yeah. I mean, that's also how I get abs when I'm prepping for this show. It's like, I got to do my crunches Sunday night so I can be ready Monday afternoon for Across the Movie Aisle. I don't, Peter, what do you make of all this? I mean, it's very, we live in a very weird and unsettled time. And I do think that there is a very specific way in which Bruce Willis is emblematic of that weird time.
Yeah. So you read, I think, a couple of the standout lines from this piece that, like, on the one hand, I can see why Sonny Bunch, the internet character, would be annoyed by those lines. Mm. But I actually think there's some real insight in those lines, even if maybe the piece doesn't exactly tease them out quite as much as I would really have liked, which is that go back to the original Die Hard, which is the movie that made Bruce Willis's career, not just as an actor, but as an action movie star. And there were two things that were that are really notable about that movie, especially in retrospect. One was that it was very much explicitly, and this was not just notable in retrospect, but very clear at the time, very much, and he was an everyman hero. He was totally positioned in opposition to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone in particular, and the kind of super buff, like giant, you know, sort of unthinking male macho-ness that dominated 1980s action films. And that was one of the reasons the movie succeeded so much. But also go back and look, that movie has guns in it. It definitely has a bunch of shooting. But it's mostly not about shooting. It's mostly about plot, and it's mostly about his cleverness in the face of a bunch of other guys with guns. And in fact, I can only think of, it's been a little while since I've seen it, but I think there's only one really kind of big shootout sequence, and that's Chief Dame Glass, right? And that's the bit in the glass room. And then the rest of it is him kind of trying to get through this gauntlet that they have created to take out guys individually without guns, or without the heavy firepower. And over time, he has become kind of a caricature of the character that he originally played, who was this sort of blue-collar guy with depth, right? Just like a macho archetype. Well, and it's a little bit of a weird and disappointing turn.
If you look at the Die Hard movies themselves, John McClane has kind of transformed from this guy who runs over, you know, glass-strewn floors in his bare feet and it hurts, to a Superman-type character where he's just being all, you know, crazy and macho and stuff. But Peter, you were making a point before this show actually started that the interesting thing about this is kind of the kind of lack of action movies just in general this year. Yeah. The weird state of action filmmaking. I mean, you've got Tenet, you've got Wonder Woman 1984, obviously, which we talked about last week. But that's kind of about it in terms of the big budget traditional action movies.
So there's also stuff like Project Power, like Extraction, like The Last Days of American Crime, and the Charlize Theron movie, Netflix did The Old Guard. Netflix did sort of four of these over the summer, and their budgets weren't small. They were $60 to $90 million or so. Those aren't tiny budgets. Now that does include all of the back end payments that they sort of bought out for their directors and stars and above the line talent. So they're not quite that big. The budgets aren't quite one-to-one when compared to a typical theatrical feature. But it's been a weird year for action movies, yeah. And like I was thinking about this, what are the memorable action sequences from this year? And I guess you could say that fake long shot from the middle of Extraction was pretty good. I liked that at the time, although actually you had to remind me of it, Sonny, when we were talking earlier.
Right, well,
The only other two action sequences that I can think of that are in features, so not on television, that are in features that really made a mark were the chase sequence in the middle of Tenet, and then even more so the opera sequence that opens Tenet, which really is a standout, remarkable action sequence and would be, I think, in most years. I watched it again recently. Like, it's great and it's going so well, and then about 90 seconds into this 5.5-minute sequence, you get John David Washington going for the coat rack, and it's the slide under the coat rack, the coat rack counter that just is like suddenly you're like, you know, you're in the hands of a great, great action sequence where just like the movement and the camera work and everything is just like going so smoothly and so well and just has been like designed within an inch of its life. And we saw that once this year. And that's really a weird thing, given that over the last decade or so, Hollywood has reoriented itself towards making more and more really big kind of action spectacles. And even something like Mulan, which is a remake of a mid-90s Disney cartoon, was remade as a not very great action movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the other thing is a lot of these movies were made. They just didn't get released.
That's right.
I mean,
but
most
we didn't get to see
got...
them, right? We didn't get to see Top right. Gun 2. We didn't get to see Black Widow. There's a bunch of stuff that we just didn't get to see. And what that meant was we just kind of didn't get the... We didn't get the action cinema that I am very used to that, like, has sort of... That has tided me over, right? Like a pretty good action movie with two great action sequences, even a not that great action movie with two great action sequences is a movie that's worth seeing and worth thinking about again. And a lot of the movies that I rewatch just when I'm bored, when it's late at night, whatever, end up being those sorts of action movies. And they just didn't come out this year. And it was really weird.
But that's true. I think that's true of pretty much every genre, right? I mean, you know, it's not like we got most of the sort of Oscar bait movies. I mean, we're going to get some more of them in the weeks to come. But, you know, it's not like I didn't get my Wes Anderson fix. Like, I didn't get the French Dispatch. And I really miss having a Wes Anderson movie, specifically one that's like basically about the New Yorker, which is about as targeted to me as a movie could possibly be. So I think like everybody is missing their favorite genre. And it makes the stuff that we did get that feels sort of anemic, I think, more frustrating, right? I mean, if you're going to get a limited number of these things, you want them all to be good and memorable because we're holding on to those new experiences so closely.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's just, it is a weird time.
I also think it's worth noting that, you know, we talked about action spectacle becoming sort of the Hollywood standard, like the genre that is most profitable and most familiar. And there is a difference between that and the sort of nastier R-rated direct-to-video, like lots of people get shot or killed in unpleasant ways, stuff that, you know, is more of what the video-on-demand stuff is. So it's not like, I mean, Willis is sort of working in a genre that Hollywood doesn't make a ton of right now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these are not, you know, direct to video like PG-13, you know, people get punched really hard and like maybe there's a magic hammer. It is sort of it has more in common with, I think, Extraction than with the stuff that we
there's also this kind of
spending a lot of time talking about.
This burgeoning genre that has it's the old man action film that has like really blown up since Taken. And
Liam
Taken
Neeson,
was
baby.
And right, Taken's proved that Liam Neeson had purchase as a mid to low budget action star who could release 1 to 3 movies a year, and you would go see it not because these movies were great. In fact, a lot of them are basically 1990s Steven Seagal films. Except
because
with Liam Neeson.
There's something incongruous and hilarious about watching Liam Neeson punch a wolf.
But also, Liam Neeson has like the greatest voice and delivery, right? And like manages to do this stuff. He doesn't have quite the physical presence that Steven Seagal had in his actual prime, you know, Under Siege era. But he has a much better physical presence than old Steven Seagal did. I mean, Steven Seagal's late movies, he spent most of them sitting down for a reason, because like Steven Seagal had gotten so out of shape that he just couldn't do the stuff that he did earlier. And that's not true of Neeson. And Neeson is sort of the elevated version of this, right? But he has helped pioneer this model of filmmaking. And you see this with Nicolas Cage too, who's doing 4 to 6 movies a year, making a bunch of money, paying off his tax debt and issues there. Some of those movies are great. Some of them are not. The main thing that matters is they've got Nicolas Cage in them. And sometimes we get a Mandy out of that, and Mandy's amazing.
Yeah.
Not for you, Alyssa, but it's a fantastic, like, weird, trippy film for the ages. But a lot of that stuff that he makes is just, like, you've never heard of it. You don't need to have heard of it. You don't need to have seen it at all.
So what you're saying is that Hollywood does, in fact, have a masculinity crisis, and all these old dudes are doing action movies in part to ward off the specter of death.
You know what's interesting?
That to make $30 million a year for working.
Well,
they're
not making 30. I guarantee you, Bruce Willis did not make $30 million a year on these movies last year. There was one interesting part in this this New York Times piece that I did not tease out, but is worth mentioning, and that is that the cheaper budgets and the kind of like lower expectations allows the actors to do some interesting and weird things. The author of the piece highlighted Thomas Jane, for instance, in the newest Bruce Willis movie, which is set in space. It's a horror movie set in space, wearing sunglasses all the time indoors, and how like that's kind of a weird, quirky thing. that you can get away with when you're doing something like this. Nick Cage, of course, has kind of made a late career out of this sort of thing. Another issue with Bruce Willis is that he just looks like he's sleepwalking through all of these movies. He never actually does anything interesting in them, which is a problem. But again, there are people who do it better. Like I mentioned Mel Gibson in Fat Man, and that's a movie where he's doing something kind of interesting and weird, and is actually putting some effort into it. All right, exit question. What, Peter, is your favorite weird performance in a cheap, recent VOD style action movie? Go.
Oh man, favorite performance. I don't know the answer to this. I need
terrible exit question.
I liked Dragged Across Concrete quite a bit. You know, I can understand why people might have issues with that movie, but I think it's really well made. And Vince Vaughn is fantastic in it, right? Like, I mean, there's stuff like that that's very good. I don't know that I have one that I want to single out as being the best.
Yeah. All right. Alyssa, any suggestions here?
Just
for people?
Go watch Looper, y'all.
You know, Looper. Looper's okay. Looper's okay. Speaking of derivative, Looper. Okay. If you enjoy this show, and who doesn't, it's great, even when I'm asking terrible exit questions like that, make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we'll have a bonus members-only episode about Twitter's first main character of 2021, Bean Dad. The guy who forced his 9-year-old daughter to learn how to use a can opener all by herself before getting milkshake ducked for his old bad tweets. Everyone gets milkshake ducked eventually. And he was this year's first victim.
Don't tweet.
Well, that's true. If you just don't tweet, you won't ever get caught. Now on to the main event. Soul. Pixar's latest computer animated confection dropped on Disney Plus at Christmas. And it is, like most Pixar-related properties, both a delight to look at and designed to tug on the heartstrings. Jamie Foxx voices Joe, a middle school teacher who, as the film begins, and much to his mother's delight, receives word that he has been promoted to full-time status at his school. With that job comes salary, benefits, a pension, and existential angst. Joe, you see, believes he's made for something more. He wants to play music for people, not teach snot-nosed punks who couldn't give a crap about what their teacher is saying. Much to his delight, he is given exactly that chance, an opportunity to fill in on piano for Dorothea Williams. Much to his shame, he dies before getting the chance to take the opportunity, falling through an open manhole cover to his almost death. He doesn't actually technically die, he winds up on life support. Not ready to pass into the great beyond, Joe is tasked with helping Soul 22, voiced by Tina Fey, find her spark so she can go down to Earth and get busy with the business of living. Can Joe succeed where Mother Teresa, among others, has failed? I have two thoughts about Soul before I kick it to you guys for discussion. Thought the first, Pete Docter, the director, is an emotional terrorist. And I mean that in the nicest way possible. Between this and Up, Inside Out, and Monsters, Inc., he has figured out, with almost mathematical precision, how to wring tears from the stingiest, driest of ducks. The DSM should include not crying during Up's marriage montage as a sign of sociopathy. I strongly believe this. The second thought is this. The score for this movie by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross is amazing, nimbly moving between jazzy arrangements and a more digital feel when extra-dimensional beings who guide the new souls through the birthing process or into the afterworld are on screen. We'll come back to the emotional terrorism in a moment, I'm sure, but first, Peter, which do you prefer, their score here or their work on Mank?
I think I actually like the score here better. I mean, I'm a huge Nine Inch Nails fan. I've been listening to Trent Reznor since I was 12 or 13 years old. It's kind of amazing to think back to like the absolutely brutal chainsaw sludge metal of the Broken EP, which was his interlude, you know, after some of the more kind of techno work that he did on Pretty Hate Machine. In which he just went like full chainsaw sledge metal. And it was, and like now that guy is making these incredibly emotionally rich and complex and like delicate, sensitive scores for children's movies. Although we should also talk about that too, which is since we started, I mean, I think it's sort of appropriate. We started with Bruce Willis entering his like late middle age phase. Soul is Pixar entering its middle age phase, right? It's not quite old man Pixar, but this is as close as we've ever gotten to like just a straightforward movie for adults from Pixar. They've always kind of flirted with this, with making movies that appeal to adults and that have adult themes and, you know, are much better made than I think many other children's movies. But typically there's a child or like some funny animal or something like that at the center of the film that grounds it in a children's reality. This is a movie about a middle-aged guy whose life didn't turn out the way he wanted it to, and who finally has that opportunity, and then, of course, has to reckon with the idea of death. Like, that's a dark movie for kids.
It's literally Up. This is what happens in Up.
Up has like the dogs and stuff, and it's also like he's so old that he's just a cartoon character.
I understand what you're saying. I've seen this talk a lot. I will say that I watched it with my 5-year-old and my 2-year-old, and they were both very into it. So I'm not.
I'm not
totally
saying that
sold.
Kids can't handle this movie.
I'm not totally sold on the idea that this is a movie that is like explicitly for adults and not for kids in a way that other Pixar movies aren't. I mean, I think you could argue that Inside Out is very much the same way. I mean, Inside Out is technically in the mind of a child, but it's about all of these middle-aged emotions arguing with each other. And again, Up is about an old man who loses his wife and has to figure out, you know, what is the purpose of living anymore. I don't know. Alyssa, what do you think? Is this a movie that kids can appreciate and understand, or is it just for the adults?
It's probably a movie that kids can appreciate and understand. I think I liked it less than the two of you did, in part because I think there was a little bit of tension between its setup and its ultimate message. And I'm assuming anyone who is listening to this podcast has watched Soul at this point, but there's this sort of concept in the movie of you can kind of go to this spiritual place called the zone when you're really good at something. You sort of detach from your body and exist in this kind of liminal space. But there is this flip side to being in the zone that where the occupants have a lot of in common, but it's in a negative way. Lost souls are people who've become obsessed with something that detaches them from everyday life. And like the people in the zone, they are, you know, completely enraptured in their obsession, but it's not elevating them, it's sort of bringing them down. And the movie, you know, the main character, Joe Gardner, you know, enters the zone a couple of times when he's having just really great moments playing piano. But the movie also suggests that his obsession with jazz has really detached him from a lot of people in his life. He hasn't pursued a romantic relationship. He has this tension with his mother. You know, there are just these sort of holes in his life. He has not fully appreciated living because he has been so obsessed with jazz. And the movie has one line about the fact that people who are in the zone have something in common with lost souls, but it never really answers the question of whether Joe's obsession with music has made him a more sort of emotionally impoverished person. And the movie leaves open at the end the question of whether he decides to become a full-time jazz musician or whether he teaches. I think that, again, there's some tension there because the message of the movie is that he's supposed to really live and engage. And the way that the movie portrays him doing that is, you know, he gains this appreciation for sort of the little things in life, like the maple seedling coming down from the tree, the joys of riding the subway. But at the same time, those are the things that he didn't appreciate when he was sort of fully obsessed with his artistry. And so I think the movie sort of kind of whiffs on the question of whether Joe's obsession was in the thing that made him great was also as a musician was also the thing that was keeping him from living his life fully. And I think the movie's both sort of metaphysics and plotting kind of whiff away from that question in a way that made it feel a little, I wouldn't say cowardly, but like not quite as brave as Pixar often is.
I can kind of see what you're saying. I disagree slightly because I do think that montage is designed to demonstrate what he has been missing and like what he so there's a whole riff in the movie about what is your spark, right? And the extra dimension, the Jerrys and the Terrys, right? They're like, well, it's not about finding your purpose. It's not about finding, you know, what you're supposed to be doing. It's about the finding the thing that kind of imbues you with life, more or less. I mean, I forget what the actual line is. And I do think that is kind of what they are getting at, both in that montage and with his performance of music and his love of music. Or am I way off here, Peter?
I don't think it's wrong. I think Alyssa is right in that the movie struggles a little bit to define what like good inspiration is versus the kind that takes too much from you. And it doesn't, and it like, it wants us to see that there is a cost to the sort of hobby or fascination or inspiration even that takes you away from real life. For too long and for too much, while also not quite getting too much into what that cost is. At the same time, this is a kid's movie. This is a kid's movie, a family movie at least, and it does give us a cost. It does say, it does show us the kind of Miyazaki-esque little demon creature that you become, right? That little sort of shadowy thing with no life to you. We're trawling around on the floor of the zone, right? And needing to be saved by...
It's very spirited, right? Away.
It's very. Yeah. I mean, this movie's so Miyazaki influenced. It's amazing. Even more so than other Pixar films. And you know that they love that. Like, there's a real clear kind of trade between their work, which maybe we should talk about a little bit. But I do think that it's difficult in a commercial family film to have those elements of real darkness and to show the ways that life can be truly disappointing and can really not work out for you. Like, that's in some way you just always kind of have to, no one has ever figured out a consistent, good commercial way that works really well with American audiences to make that cost clear and make it stick. At some point end, you always have to kind of pull back. And like, that's what Steven Spielberg always does, right? Which is one of the reasons that he's, you know, so successful is every time he shows you a cost, he'll walk right up to the line. And then at the end of War of the Worlds, there's the missing son. He's just been in Boston the whole time. He wasn't actually going to kill the son, right? Because that would have been too much. And there's just this sort of commercial sensibility that Pixar has to work within. The fact that they give us a cost and show it to us at all, I think, is it's not as brave as they could be. But it takes it further than a lot of studios would.
I think there's actually a fairly simple potential fix for that in this movie, though. There are these repeated references to someone named Lisa, who clearly Joe had a thing for and like didn't pursue. And you could just show, you know, Joe finally getting up the courage to call her and like, she's married with kids. She's somewhere else. But then he goes back to teach at school and you can see that he's going to have another kind of connection that's going to be really valuable to him. I mean, I think it's the rare movie that I wish were a little bit longer. Like, I think you could have added 5 minutes and maybe stuck the landing a little bit better.
See, I actually like that they leave it open-ended when he is, like, given a second chance at life, what he actually wants to do with his life and what choice he makes. Because I do think I think the easy way out of this would have been for him to like realize, okay, I'm happy being a teacher.
Yeah.
And then just have him, you know, show him with the student who, you know, he convinces to love the art form, you know, she's doing a great job or whatever. But I also don't think that would be honest to the spirit of the whole enterprise, because I do think that there's still, look, people, you know, the heart wants what it wants, right?
Yeah.
And you know, if deep within his soul he thinks I need to be a famous jazz musician, then I think it would be dishonest to like write that part out of his soul, right?
I mean, I can see the level of ambiguity. At the same time, you have that sort of wonderful scene where he plays this totally transcendent concert with Dorothy and the band. And then realizes that like the big emotional catharsis that he thought was going to follow a moment like that is not coming. You know, it's like, It's the, you know, the parable of the fish in the ocean. It's like, you know, this is just water. Nope. This is the ocean. This is what it is.
This,
like,
is definitely a movie born of a string of gigantic studio feature hits that, like, Pete Docter is like, man, I thought if you told me when I was 25 that I would just make tons of movies that people would love and would be really wonderful and well-reviewed and make huge amounts of money, I would have felt like, gosh, I'm there. I've made it. Nope. You just got to wake up the next day and make the next movie.
Yeah.
But they're good.
They are.
I mean, I didn't not like it. I just, it's, in a way, it's so good that I almost wish it was just a little bit better. And I think to a certain extent, I was just a sucker for, it's like, this is a movie about people in New York doing things, right? Like, they're eating pizza in public. They're riding public transportation. They're, like, going to jazz clubs. They, like, there's, like, a dry cleaners and seamstresses store that, like, hasn't been shut down because no one gets work clothes anymore. Yeah. It's just, it's a gorgeous looking movie. And it is such a wonderful visual testament to just the joys of everyday life. And it definitely made me feel like I've been sitting in my house for 10 months and I don't know how much longer I can put up with that.
I mean, there's a weird way in which this is like the little indie film that you wish that, like, more studios would take a chance on, like, at the $8 million level, right? And yes, obviously it's animated and it does a bunch of stuff. It's
probably
that,
$150 million Pixar movie.
Right. It's a quite expensive movie and it does a bunch of stuff in a way that only animation can do. All of these scenes in the before, the before life or whatever, the after thing, you know, all of these, right, like these kind of jazzy two-dimensional, right, things running around with these little Miyazaki creatures and all that stuff, right? It's very specifically animated, and yet ultimately this is a movie about a middle-aged jazz player guy who is like a teacher and has a midlife crisis that where he has to go, in the end he has to go talk to his mom, and it's like a little indie flick, you know, just done at this mega level that you can't imagine a live action version of this movie of any, like, it's hard to imagine it getting greenlit at all, but certainly with, like, the effects that would be required. I mean, at $150 million budget level, you just sort of can't imagine this getting done. And somehow Pixar, on the strength of its brand and on the strength of just, like, 20 plus years of really great storytelling, has figured out how to do this and how to sell it to people in a way that doesn't really exist outside of Pixar right now.
One thing I realized we haven't talked about at all is Tina Fey's character. And this has been kind of, you know, controversial, both because Tina Fey is considered problematic now and because it...
What did Tina Fey do?
Oh, she's just like a white lady who has made a couple of TV shows that have not aged terribly well.
According to who? Not me.
The internet.
Controversy.
The internet. And, you know, she ends up, like, her character ends up occupying his body for a lot of the movie while he's stuck as middle as, like, a cat. I was curious what you thought of this movie, or this, you thought of that character, which I felt was, like, particularly affecting as someone who has a toddler. But yeah, I was curious how you guys felt about 22, since we've spent all of this time talking about Joe Gardner and none about his, like, sort of ostensible co-star and the person who ends up teaching him that, you know, leaves falling from a tree in autumn is sometimes, like, all you need to appreciate life.
Pizza.
Yeah.
Peter, you want to go first?
I mean, I like Tina Fey. I even as somebody who is not a television comedy watcher, she's a appealing persona, and the fact that she's obviously, like, a super hyper intelligent writer, just, like, if you know anything about her or have ever experienced, like, anything she's participated in, is super appealing. I thought the character was really fun, and, like, the idea that here's Tina Fey as a, like, a pre-existing half a soul who has spent eternity being tutored by, like, the great eminences of history and, like, irritating the hell out of them in a really funny way is one of the things about that is that it is a risky gambit as a plot device, because if those bits aren't really good, they aren't really sharp and funny, then it's like, it's kind of a bad idea that just doesn't work. And it's a really hard thing to like think of and then execute on. And you got to imagine that, sure, Pixar has a bunch of good writers and talented animators, but that's Tina Fey making those scenes work.
She, her character is a troll's troll. So I approve of 22 on that level. No, I mean, I think there's a very funny line where the 22 talks about how, like, she has the voice of a middle-aged white woman, and she could have anything. She, like, mimics a bunch of other voices because that is the voice that is most annoying to people right now at this moment in history. And I thought that was, like, a clever, subtle dig at the people, Alyssa, who on the internet who think she's bad now because she has made good TV shows that they all laughed at and now they have to denounce for being problematic. You know.
I don't know if the two of you noticed this, but I thought one of the most interesting decisions in the movie is like almost invisible. But when 22 is falling towards Earth, at the climax of the movie, it is very clear that she is going to end up and be born as a human in China, just from the map. I don't know if either of you saw that, but it's like they make very clear that like that is where she's going. And interestingly, this movie has done quite well in China, and sort of pushed back against a bunch of the stereotypes about Chinese moviegoers, among them that they will not watch movies about Black people, and thus that like this has been sort of a bit of Hollywood conventional wisdom that Chinese audiences are racist, and that has become a block on, you know, making big movies around Black stars. But I thought, you know, I don't think that this movie is big in China because there's this little nod to China at the end. But I thought it was just sort of a perfect example of how that audience is now always sort of in mind when studios are making these decisions. And if you can work in sort of a gentle nod there. And I thought, I mean, this is, it's not, you know, obnoxiously done at all. It's not pandering at all. But I do sort of appreciate in a way that it acknowledges that Chinese audiences are going to be an audience for this movie. And also that, you know, it's just a big part of the world. If someone was going to be like born randomly, you know,
they're probably going to be born in China or India. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there is that. There's just like a numbers game aspect to it. This is beyond the scope of my knowledge, and I should probably have contacted some of my priest friends on Twitter before broaching this potentially problematic point. But the conception of the afterlife,
I'm curious to see where this goes.
The conception of the afterlife and the pre-life in this movie is like explicitly not Christian. I mean, it's like it felt more Eastern than Western. Am I wrong
here? It
also
feels like just sort of a funny riff on like personality quizzes
What it reminded me most of was Defending Your Life, the Albert Brooks movie, Defending Your Life, which is one of my absolute favorite afterlife movies, because it kind of envisions this idea of the afterlife as the place where you go and you're like, well, did you improve enough to get to go on to the next level? Nope. You gotta do it again. And that's kind of what it felt like here, slightly different, obviously. Anyway, I mentioned this because I wonder if that is another reason why it is picking up steam in China. I mean, that's the interesting thing, is that it grossed more in its second week than it did in its first, which obviously is not the most usual circumstance, but maybe that is something we can think about.
I mean, certainly it's a movie that is sort of not deliberately culturally off-putting, in a way that I think is like canny without feeling pandering. It's smart, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Jazz is good.
Yeah, there is that. People love jazz.
The music in the movie is fantastic and really well rendered. And I mean, not just the Trent Reznor stuff, but just the jazz aspect of it is really faithful to how jazz bands sort of operate and sound. And like this movie just sounds phenomenal in a way that other films reach for but rarely get to.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Soul?
Thumbs up.
Big thumbs up. And if I'd seen this before doing our top three, I would have put it in my top three, which was actually a top eight or whatever.
Yeah, well, yeah, that doesn't count because your list was a million items long. So you would have just added it on to, you know, you don't.
I might have made it tied for number one with the two films that I put at number one.
Ridiculous. All right, that is... Oh, I thumbs up for me as well, in case anyone cares. That is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check us out at the members-only episode that we have going up at Bulwark Plus. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow a podcast audience, and if we don't grow, we'll die. If you didn't love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I didn't do a great job of hosting this week, so feel free to yell at me. But I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed yet again. See you guys next week.